This is your host, Webster Tarpley, reporting from Washington, D.C. This week we're dealing with a solemn occasion of tragic proportions and with the most sinister overtones. The long process of the seizure of power by the Wall Street puppet Barack Hussein Obama, Barry Sotero, constitutionally unqualified for the presidency, not a citizen, not born in the continental United States. This process of seizure of power now reaches its culmination, and the nation leaps into the abyss. We are now adrift on the sea of indentures, with a Congress determined to impose the Mussolini fascist corporate state and a president determined to show his loyalty and serviceability to Wall Street. In this terrible situation, who can speak for the American people? The American people, duped, terrorized, lied to, miseducated, intimidated, who can speak for the American people? Is it the Wall Street Party, the one that wants renewable energy, that believes in the new myth of global warming, and that strives for the fascist corporate state? Clearly not. It is the minority party, the low-wage, sweatshop, reactionary, imperialist, militarist, neocon party, recently discredited by many years in power? Clearly not. So others will have to try to speak for the American people. And I will try my best to express some, at least, of what I believe to be the overriding interests of the American people at this point. What would a real president say in the inaugural address next week? What would a real president say in the State of the Union address soon to follow? A real president, I would submit, would have to say something like this. My fellow citizens, I speak to you at a time of acute national crisis. We face the perspective of a world economic and financial depression of incalculable severity. It is a crisis without end. It is an abyss without an exit. We have just had the worst unemployment report since 1945, with more jobs lost now than since the demobilization after World War II. Our real rate of unemployment must be approaching 20%, although this is masked by the statistics of the Department of Labor. We are currently losing jobs at a rate of about 500,000 per month, with indications that this rate is accelerating. Especially hard hit are the few remaining productive jobs in areas of real, tangible, physical production, in areas like the automobile industry, the aluminum production industry, and other forms of heavy industry. Every one of our states is now undergoing some kind of a budget crisis, led by California, which has a $60 billion hole in its budget. In addition to the skyrocketing rate of unemployment, our unemployment insurance funds are close to exhaustion. In Michigan, one out of every eight people, 12% of the entire population, is now living on food stamps. And these funds, too, are dangerously close to being exhausted. We must now think of emergency action to save human civilization itself and to ward off genocide from the American people. You know, or should know, that up to 40,000 people a day die in this world of malnutrition, starvation, and diseases that can be cured for just a few pennies, like diarrhea and related ailments. That so far has been the life of the third world. Under this economic depression, there is a clear and present danger that these forms of genocide will now encroach into the United States. And as your president, I must do everything in my power to prevent this. As we survey this scene, we must say that the free market, private enterprise, and the current banking and business leadership have failed. They have struck out, and we cannot afford to give them any more strikes under this situation. It is therefore imperative that emergency action be undertaken in the tradition of how presidents have dealt with previous crises. The measures that I begin to outline for you now are all conducted under the aegis of the Defense Production Act, the Trading with the Enemy Act, and other precedents from World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. I also appeal to the inherent powers of the presidency, the implied powers of the presidency. The Constitution is not a suicide pact, and we must therefore have the ability to do what is necessary in a speedy way. I invite the Congress to revisit the measures that I now announce, but I assure the people that the legislative logjam and the incompetence of the current leadership around Pelosi, Reid, Boehner, and McConnell will not be allowed to generate casualties here on the home front if people are foreclosed on and freeze to death under bridges in this terrible winter. We are dealing with a banking panic. The banking panic began in 2007. It is similar to the banking panic that faced Franklin D. Roosevelt when he was inaugurated at this place in March of 1933. On that day, every bank in the United States was effectively shut down, and the economic heart of the United States had ceased to beat. This time around, the banking panic began in 2007, in the summer, with the countrywide bank panic run. This was soon followed by Northern Rock in Britain and Ireland. In 2008, panic runs have caused the demise of banks and investment banks such as Bear Stearns, American International Group Insurance Company, Lehman Brothers, and indeed Citibank. At the end of 2008, in a supremely ill-advised move, a bailout of these bankrupt financial institutions was stampeded through the Congress with the help of the Republican candidate McCain and, above all, of the Democratic candidate Obama. They are therefore co-responsible for the disaster of what has come to be called the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Even so, under the TARP, Citibank has gone bankrupt for a second time and has had to be bailed out for a second time. Bank of America, after being bailed out under the TARP, has now gone through bankruptcy in effect in the last 48 hours. The evolution of the stock price of J.P. Morgan Chase suggests that it cannot be far behind. Trillions of dollars have been injected. Something on the order of $8 trillion or more have been injected into the banking system. Nevertheless, the banking panic continues. The lesson of history is that once the panic run has begun to undermine a speculative bubble, there is no power in the universe that can maintain the fictitious, unrealistic, bloated, and speculative values of paper promises to pay. And this cannot be our concern. We must turn away in our economic thinking from the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the NASDAQ, the Standard & Poor's, and other purely financial indices. We must begin to think about industrial production, freight car loadings, truck loadings, the average longevity of our people, the infant mortality rate, the rates of incarceration, the amount of calories in the diet, and other indices of real production, tangible physical wealth available to our people.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Gathered today, I see one-third of a nation slipping into poverty. And if the current policy trends are not reversed, that one-third of a nation already in poverty will be joined by more and more. All measures taken so far under Bush, with the support of Obama, have reflected the failed mentality of Herbert Hoover and the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Vast sums of money, liquidity, pumped into an intrinsically bankrupt banking system in an attempt to prop up bankrupt institutions and to maintain the bloated, fictitious valuations of various forms of securities. This approach failed in 1931, 32, and 33, and it is sure to fail today. It is likely to lead to a dollar crisis, as the trillions and trillions of dollars at zero interest rates are pumped into the dollar economy. The value of the dollar abroad is destined to fall precipitously. The recent interlude of deflation, when the oil price went from $160 to $30 a barrel, will be replaced once again by a phase of dollar hyperinflation. We must remember that the value of the dollar is the value of the dollar in the world. The value abroad determines the value at home. Hyperinflation is a terrible plague. We've never had it in the United States, apart from the continental currency of the American Revolution and the Confederate currency of the Civil War. Hyperinflation is when you take your dollars to the store in a wheelbarrow and you bring home what you've bought in your pocket. It's where you pay for a meal in a restaurant as soon as you've ordered it, because if you wait 2 hours until you're finished eating, the price may have doubled or tripled. Where you've got to push to the head of the supermarket checkout line in order to avoid paying a higher price. When as soon as you get cash, you've got to spend it immediately, even on something you don't need, because that something can be bartered for something you do need, whereas the cash is a wasting asset and will essentially approach a value of zero if you keep it in your pocket for too many days. We will need a new term to describe the horrors of the present situation. About a year ago, I proposed to call it hyperstagflation. That is to say, hyperinflation combined with high levels of unemployment. The misery index, in other words, will eclipse even the high levels of the Carter administration and will go into the ionosphere. We can call it hyperinflationary depression. On the whole, similar to what happened in Germany in 1923, but incomparably worse. There are two immediate issues that must now be addressed in the name of economic recovery. The first is the ill-advised troubled asset relief program, which was extorted from the Congress under threats and hysteria, including threats of martial law in September and October of 2008. Again, in the spirit of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and Herbert Hoover, not one penny of this money has gone to individuals. Nobody has been kept in their home. Nothing has been done to stop foreclosures. All money has gone to banks, insurance companies, investment banks, stockbrokers, credit card companies, and other financial institutions. There is no accounting of what happened to this money under the TARP, the bailout. We do know, however, what the banks are not doing. They are not lending. They did not lend to General Motors. They did not lend to Ford. They did not lend to Chrysler in the recent crisis. The United States government had to jump in to save the Detroit automakers from immediate chain reaction bankruptcy that would have caused an increase of about 3 million in the unemployment rolls over a period of just a few weeks, plunging large areas of the industrialized or formerly industrialized Midwest into abject poverty and the collapse of the tissue of civilization itself. This was a wonderful chance for the banks to show their gratitude for the money that they had received under the TARP. Instead, they stood aside, obdurate, and concentrated on their derivatives portfolios and their other paper investments, including bidding up the price of oil, if they could. This monstrous crime and tragic mistake must not be repeated. The second round of the TARP has now been approved. The Bush administration has attempted to funnel that money immediately into the bankrupt coffers of Bank of America. As of today, that bankrupt policy is to be reversed, and indeed the money is to be recovered. The clawback operation is now on, and I have ordered the Attorney General to begin operations in that regard. The second round of the TARP, totaling approximately $350 billion, must go in the first place to the states. Every state is facing a budget crisis. Here we're talking about the presuppositions of civilization itself. The police department, the fire departments, public education, libraries, hospitals, schools, universities, and other absolutely vital services, including Medicaid, which is the only way that poor people can get medical care in this country other than by going to an emergency room. Therefore, the second round of the TARP is hereby commandeered, and it will be sent to the states. The state of California starts with a $60 billion budget deficit, and the other states are not far behind. Concerning the banks, what should be done with them? It is a general rule of competent accounting that when a bank has between 10 and 12% of non-performing assets, that bank is bankrupt. According to my best estimate, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Bank of America, Bank of New York Mellon, and several other money center financial institutions now fulfill the prima facie technical definition of bankruptcy. I am now ousting Sheila Bair as the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. She will now be investigated for her role in seizing Washington Mutual, presumably as a means of propping up the even more bankrupt J.P. Morgan. The successor of Sheila Bair at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, joined by the controller of the currency, the new head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and the Presidential Working Group on Financial Markets, known to some of you as the PPT, or Plunge Protection Team, they are now directed to seize J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Bank of America, Bank of New York Mellon, and other institutions. We must also address the process by which this money was extorted. I call your attention to a meeting in September at the offices of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, attended by Henry Paulson, Ben Bernanke, Geithner, Diamond of J.P. Morgan Chase, Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, Thane of Merrill Lynch, Mack of Morgan Stanley, Pandit of Citibank, and other bankers. Here we have a prima facie conspiracy to defraud the United States of America. I'm directing the Attorney General to begin criminal proceedings against these individuals and others unknown at this time, but that may become known in the process of the survey. Beyond the troubled asset recovery program, we must now start an economic recovery program. Proposals for this, currently circulating in the Congress, now go up to $850 billion.
Listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Let us now address the question of a recovery program adequate to lead the United States out of the current world economic depression and at the same time provide both a powerful locomotive and a persuasive example for similar measures of economic reform and recovery across the world. Let us assume that we're working with a nice round $1 trillion U.S. dollars. The main goal should be to create high technology, high in energy intensity, and high capital intensity jobs across the board. In order to clear the decks, however, we must first begin with a phase of rebuilding and repairing the collapsing infrastructure of the United States, in particular, the interstate highway system, which, when it was begun under President Eisenhower, was the biggest road program since the Romans, is now in disrepair. Bridges are falling down, highways are reduced to a deplorable state. The precondition for the other points of the program must be to restore the interstate highway system and indeed to expand it to some extent in order to permit the rest of what we need to talk about. Our water systems are now more than 100 years old in many cases. The water and sewage systems of major cities, more than a century old, falling into disrepair, crumbling just in the suburbs of Washington, two important water main breaks in the last 6 months that deprived hundreds of thousands of people of water and indeed threatened the lives of motorists and others. We must now begin a comprehensive national program to restore water systems and to restore water projects, including irrigation projects along the American rivers and the dikes and levees of the Mississippi, Missouri, and other major waterways. Irrigation systems must be maintained in order to move American agriculture in a more intensive direction. We currently have a deficit of 1,000 hospitals which have been closed in the past 3 to 4 decades. Most of these in rural America, in the high plains of the Midwest and the Great Basin, but also in the impoverished inner cities of the large metropolitan areas. 1,000 hospitals must now be restored in order to make sure that people who have heart attacks will not be hours and hours away from medical attention that can save their lives. At the same time, we must attempt to provide an increase in the productivity of labor. We know how to do this. It should be a spectacular and visible indication that the man-hour productivity in the American economy is going to be radically improved. I propose the following. In the 25 largest urban areas, let us build for the first time or rebuild comprehensive, modern, attractive, high-speed urban mass transit systems, relying where possible on the ultra-modern magnetic levitation railway system, but also including light rail, subways, fast rail, and other variations according to the needs of the specific situation. These 25 largest urban areas will therefore cut hours and hours of wasted time from the commutes and from the traffic jams of many, many American citizens. At the same time, for rural America, let us begin a transcontinental railroad based on magnetic levitation, making it possible to go from New York to San Francisco in 3 to 4 hours in complete comfort and in total safety. In the Northeast Corridor, in Southern California, in the Chicago area, in the suburbs of Atlanta and Houston and Boulder and Denver, Colorado, we will also be able to use maglev for commuter rail, making the commute, once again, much more livable. The goal of these measures is to make life easier and more attractive, but also to increase the productivity of labor. Productivity of labor in the United States historically increased by something approaching 3% in the 1950s and 1960s. By the 1970s, because of the decline of the space program and the oil shocks, which were artificial and orchestrated and generated in their nature, the rise in the productivity of labor had fallen to only 2% a year. Our best estimate is that that productivity rate is now negative. So we've got to turn that around immediately. Notice that I say nothing of green. I say nothing of renewable. What is known as green energy or renewable energy represents a net loss for the economy. The more green and renewable energy facilities you build, the poorer you get. The farther and farther your economy will sink into depression. I call your attention to the example of Mussolini's Italy in the 1930s, trying to use ethanol to avoid League of Nations sanctions on oil. Green is a net loss, because the amount of energy that has to be put into the production of energy is greater than the energy that will ever come out of these green or renewable facilities. Think of ethanol, where the creation of a gallon of ethanol requires more energy, including in the area of petroleum, than will ever be gotten out of the ethanol, and so on down the road. The technology of the windmill is hundreds, if not thousands, of years old. It is obsolete. The solar cell has not become economical at this point. We know what works. 100 nuclear reactors will work. And this is the heart of the energy grid renewal of the economic recovery program. 100 fourth-generation, high-temperature, pebble-bed reactors of the safest and most modern type will be begun under this program. I will use the executive powers of the presidency to prevent the rich elitists and Malthusian fanatics of the Wilderness Society, the Friends of the Earth, the Sierra Club, the Canoe Federation, Earth First, and Greenpeace from preventing the essential energy infrastructure for the recovery being provided to the American people. Now, where might this $1 trillion come from? It could be done as part of the federal budget, but I suggest that it be done in a different way. Acting with my powers under the Defense Production Act and the Trading with the Enemy Act, as well as the inherent and implied powers of the presidency, I announce the seizure and nationalization of the Federal Reserve System in Washington, D.C., and every one of the Federal Reserve branches, starting with the one in New York City. Their membership in the Bank for International Settlements, a sinister international cabal, is hereby terminated. This situation of the Federal Reserve has gone on for almost 100 years in a totally illegal and unconstitutional form. Most eloquently, it has been a failure. The Federal Reserve has failed to prevent the crash of 1929, indeed contributed to the crash of 1929. It failed to prevent the banking panic of 1932 to 1933, and now the Federal Reserve has struck out for the third time. And as I play the game, three strikes and you're out. The Federal Reserve is now a Bureau of the United States Treasury. I've directed the 1st Infantry Division of Fort McNair, Virginia, to use one of its battalions to place a cordon around the Mariner Eccles and related buildings of the Federal Reserve here in Washington, D.C., to prevent functionaries from coming in or out, to prevent any tampering with computers. This Federal Reserve system will now be subjected to a comprehensive audit, something that has never happened in the past. And I demand that Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Paul Adolf Volcker, and all other former members of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors and the heads of the branch offices, starting with the New York and Chicago bureaus, hold themselves in abeyance that their passports be delivered to the United States attorneys, because the Attorney General is now going to investigate them and their acts of malfeasance and nonfeasance during their times as head of the Federal Reserve or as responsible executives thereof. I am therefore seizing and nationalizing the Federal Reserve System and all of its branches. They will henceforth function as the fourth bank of the United States, in the tradition of the first bank of the United States created by Alexander Hamilton, the second bank of the United States created by James Madison, the third bank of the United States attempted by Daniel Webster and Henry Clay, the fourth bank of the United States will issue currency at interest rates set by public law after a thorough political discussion by the House, the Senate, through hearings, and then signed by the President. Such legislation will also determine the destination of such credits. In general, only productive activities will be eligible. Real physical commodity production, the creation of tangible physical wealth, things you can wear, things you can eat, things you can live in, drive, use as a machine tool, otherwise use as the tool of a trade. In short, industrial and agricultural production, mining, construction, infrastructure, public works, anything that creates a necessary or productive service. No money under this program will be available for financial services, speculation, derivatives. No money for drug money laundering or narcotics in any form, no money for gambling, no money for prostitution, pornography, or other sociopathic activities. The people who want to pursue those activities, to the extent that they are legal, will take their chances in the free market that they claim to believe in and to admire so much. They certainly cannot come to government to expect to be subsidized. This $1 trillion of federal lending, not federal spending, but federal lending will be available as recovery loans, long-term credit that will be available for productive activity at rates less than 1% and in many cases at 0%. The loans will therefore be issued between 1 and 0% interest rates for maturities of 20, 30, 40, 50 years as needed. Up to now, the banks have not lent, and the government has tried to prod the banks into lending by pumping money into them. And the banks have not begun to lend, as we can see from the crisis of the Detroit auto industry. Therefore, let's face the reality. If you want loans to be issued, if you want credit to be available, then pass the legislation, make the credit available. If you want lending, then get the lending going. This money is available to the Detroit automakers and their subcontractors, to Silicon Valley, to biotech, to pharma, to the farm industry, to anybody in short who is creating a commodity or a service which is required. This extends down to the automobile repair shop, the dry cleaner, and the restaurant in your area. All of these provide necessary commodities or services, but it does not include the bucket shop, the gambling, the mutual fund store, or anything of this sort. At the same time, we must undo the crimes of deregulation. First among these is the 1.5 quadrillion, that is to say the 1.5 thousand trillion derivatives bubble, the greatest cancerous, speculative, fictitious paper bubble that has ever been created in human history. I'm talking here about paper based on paper, the mortgage-backed securities, the asset-backed securities, the collateralized debt obligations, the credit default swaps, the structured investment vehicles, the auction rate securities. All of these are herewith shredded and deleted. Under my powers of the Defense Production Act, the Trading with the Enemy Act, and other relevant legislation, no derivatives shall be honored henceforth in the United States. It is now a federal crime to buy them, to sell them, to issue them, to pay them, to claim payment on them, or to use derivatives in any other way. I'm declaring war on the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. Under the Trading with the Enemy Act, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association is hereby declared an enemy alien. All of their assets in the United States are hereby seized and impounded, and we will track them down across the globe as we once did with the Nazis and stop them from carrying on their parasitical and socially destructive activities. In connection with this, a debt moratorium is now in force on all financial debt in this economy for the duration of the crisis. Related to this, foreclosures are halted. It is now a federal crime under the Trading with the Enemy Act and the Defense Production Act to force a homeowner to leave a primary residence as a result of non-payment of a mortgage. Those who try to do this will be looking at the walls of Leavenworth and other federal prisons. Foreclosures on homes, that is to say primary residences, are hereby stopped. There must be no shutdown of any farm, any business, any infrastructure, any rail line, any airline, any taxi company, trucking company, ferry, or other public infrastructure, any toll bridge that's privately owned. None of these can be shut down, and above all, no business which is engaged in productive activity or providing a socially necessary service can be shut down. Foreclosures have ceased for the duration of the crisis. This twin protection of a debt moratorium and a ban on foreclosures will stop the threatened thermodynamic death or irreversible breakdown crisis of this economy. Adjustable rate mortgages are now illegal. They never should have been allowed. This was an unforgivable lapse of regulatory oversight. Adjustable rate mortgages are now unenforceable. Similarly, any contract inside the United States that refers to London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR, a foreign financial speculative index beyond the regulatory purview of the United States, all of those contracts are now declared unenforceable, null and void. The Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, under its new leadership, will henceforth re-regulate all markets, starting with the ban on derivatives, but including an intervention into the commodities and oil markets based on position limits, full margin requirements of 100%, and the systematic distinction between speculators and hedgers, where speculators must be put in a subordinate position to the needs of people who are in the market as hedgers because they're also producing something with the goods that are being bought and sold. I've ordered the new head of the Securities and Exchange Commission to end the practice of naked shorting, to reinstitute the uptick rule. And in general, we have now reinstituted the Glass-Steagall Act, according to which it is illegal to combine an investment bank and a bank in the same company. That is to say, the stock-jobbing aspect and the depository commercial or savings bank aspect are now separated, as they were to such good intent, from the 1930s into the 1990s. The abolition of the Glass-Steagall Act, one of the critical pieces of human folly that have led us to this terrible situation. So re-regulation is in force on all of those fronts. At the same time, in addition to our 25 cities fast rail or maglev mass transit, our transcontinental maglev system, we need to reconstruct, to rebuild, and reconvert Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors. These three companies are hereby nationalized, and they will be run not under the purview of accountants, Wall Street hedge fund managers, or other experts in speculative paper transactions. They will be put under competent industrial engineers, and they will be retooled to build tractors, mass transit equipment, the nuclear reactors that we will be installing in many parts of the country, and equipment for the permanent colonization and exploration of space, starting with the moon and Mars. These measures, too, are in the great American tradition. The transcontinental railroad of Abraham Lincoln and Justin Morrill was a key part of the economy in the period of the Civil War and thereafter. The Tennessee Valley Authority of Franklin D. Roosevelt, a key means of the economic modernization of the New South. The Manhattan Project, unlocking the secrets of the atom. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, putting men on the moon for the first time. We will now build on this heritage as part of our economic recovery program. In order to get out of the current world economic and financial depression, in the tradition of the Transcontinental Railroad, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Manhattan Project, and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, let us build on this great heritage. I propose today three science drivers to provide high rates of technological innovation and scientific discovery to allow modernization. Let us remember that the NASA moonshot of the 1960s put $4 into the economy for every dollar spent, and this kind of multiplier effect can be enhanced, not just attained, as we go forward in the future. Let us start with $50 billion for the space program. This means the permanent colonization and exploration of the moon, Mars, and nearby objects in the solar system, the development of permanent space stations, and the beginning of large-scale industrial production in space, as well as energy production in space, quite possibly including the capturing of solar radiation in Earth orbit. Our second science driver, the biomedical research program, the only possible way to realize real savings in Medicare and Medicaid and other healthcare expenditures is to find cures for cancer, diabetes, tuberculosis, malaria, and other dread diseases. We declare war on them. We will pursue cures, and we will spend money as fast as possible in this area. As fast as the money can productively be spent, we will increase the potential of nursing schools, medical schools, hospitals, and others, and we will make the system more economical by curing diseases which now take hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars of treatment to deal with. Our third science driver is in the area of high-energy physics, another $50 billion initially. Beyond the current generation of nuclear power reactors, we will require, according to all indications, thermonuclear fusion power reactors, and quite possibly beyond them, reactors based on antimatter systems. This is the kind of area where we need engineers, scientists, mathematicians, and I'm therefore announcing a return of the National Defense Education Act of Senator Ralph Yarborough of Texas, which will allow the training of these technical personnel, as was done in the post-Sputnik period of the 1950s and 1960s. Concerning our farm economy, the much-neglected farm economy must now be restored. This is the immediate vital interest of everyone in maintaining sufficient levels of nutrition and food stocks. We start with no foreclosures on family farms. We continue with a debt moratorium for family farms, just as for all other areas of the productive economy. The parity price of the United States Department of Agriculture will henceforth be set at 110% of parity and up. The parity price reflects the normal price necessary for the capital inputs, labor, and other essential elements of producing food, plus a reasonable level of profit for the family farmer and family. If 110% is not enough, then it will be increased. I recall to everyone that during World War II, when food was necessary to win the war against Nazi fascism, it was necessary to put the parity price well above 100% and in some cases approaching 125%. Farmers in general need to be encouraged to produce. We need more food, not less. Worldwide food stocks, in particular grain stocks, are now at alarmingly low levels. Famine is already in progress in many parts of the world. In order to deal with that, we must return to one of the Eisenhower administration's best programs, food for peace, not food for imperialist interference in the affairs of other countries, but simply a means of preventing genocide when this can be easily done. For small business here in the United States, we require tax relief. This will largely be through the single-payer Medicare for All system of health care. At the same time, we propose to shift the tax burden off of small business onto Wall Street and the banks. This will be done through a Tobin tax or securities transfer tax of 1% on all turnover of stocks, bonds, debt instruments, and other forms of securities. At the same time, we must look at the world of the foundations, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, huge sums of money that are taxed at a very low rate. They generally represent the ill-gotten gains of robber barons or more modern monopolists like Bill Gates, and have taken on a life of their own, led and administered by Malthusian foundation bureaucrats dedicated to the preservation of a fragmentation and racist division of the American people. These tax rates must now be radically increased. We propose an exemption for foundations that are willing to put money into hospitals, medical research, libraries, universities, and other positive areas of activity. But for those foundations that insist on funding projects of social manipulation, brainwashing, mind-bending, the fomenting of racism and incendiary rhetoric in the various ethnic groups of the United States, a vast increase in the tax rate will be immediately implemented as part of lifting the tax burden off the children or grandchildren of the people who were looted to get that money in the first place. In terms of individuals, tax reform will take the immediate form of an increase of the personal exemption to $25,000, of an increase of the standard deduction per family to $30,000. This means that a family of four under the new system will pay no tax at all under the first $130,000 of income. We propose a substantial increase in the earned income tax credit for poor taxpayers, allowing the tax system to be used to supplement the incomes of those who are below the poverty level. The poverty level, in the meantime, will be revised upward to represent a more realistic figure. The system of education credits, the HOPE, lifetime learning and related credits, will be improved. For health care, it is clear that private insurance has once again struck out. AIG, MetLife, Prudential, the other members of the Hartford Cabal, that is to say the Connecticut Mutual Life Insurance Company and others, have struck out. They have done more to invest in derivatives and in advertising and lobbying than they have put money into improvements of health care. We propose Medicare for all as an option for anyone who wants it. Those who say that they believe in competition will obviously welcome the entry of Medicare for all into the area of general insurance for any person, and I stress for any person, under U.S. jurisdiction. The only way, once again, we can realize actual savings in healthcare is by a process of discovery so that we can develop cures. Finally, in this area of soft infrastructure, we can no longer afford to put large numbers of the younger generation on the human junk heap from lack of education. No one can be employable and productive in the 21st century without a college education. Our immediate goal must therefore be college for all, quickly followed as soon as possible by advanced degrees for all. College for all means that any person getting a high school diploma or equivalency diploma, GSA, in any part of the United States must be guaranteed 4 years of college through a combination of funded community college and state universities, so that no one will need to go onto the human junk heap under this new administration. We will allow no entitlement reform of the type discussed by the Democratic candidate Obama. Entitlement reform means chiseling and gouging, looting money out of Social Security and Medicare to convoy that money into Wall Street, and it will not be allowed. No entitlement reform will be allowed under the new administration. The current entitlements represent the economic rights of the American people, secured by them through decades of mass struggle, through labor, progressive, and other movements, and they are declared sacrosanct. Instead of looting Social Security under the entitlement reform demagogic label, we must increase the size of the average Social Security pension. The reason for this is obvious. In recent decades, many unsuspecting wage earners, lured by the siren song of Wall Street speculation, easy money, and speculative gain, have been induced to put large amounts of their personal savings into 401k and IRA accounts, which were based on highly speculative stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and other paper instruments. Large amounts of these monies have now been obliterated. They have been wiped out, not so much stolen, but destroyed as the speculative bubble has come down. The only way to secure the old age dignity and indeed the survival for many millions of our people is to increase the average size of the Social Security pension and to extend Social Security coverage to all wage earners, self-employed, and others by facilitating that process. We will also not allow the looting of Medicare. Indeed, Medicare will be expanded to compete with any remaining insurance companies of the private sector, and we are confident that Medicare for all will prove itself to be more effective, more attractive, and more economical, and will eventually evolve into a single-payer system. We will stop the chiseling of Medicare and Medicaid. Full funding will be provided. The reimbursement of doctors and hospitals will be restored to reasonable levels that allow the survival of these institutions. And we will be ruthless in dealing with derivatives where they show up in insurance companies and private insurance firms. This will make those companies eligible to being seized for abusing the public trust in what they were doing. As a result of this, a significant state sector will emerge and will compete with the private sector, and we will be able to demonstrate in practice that a mixed economy is a perfectly viable and indeed superior system to the free market, wild capitalism, deregulated casino speculative orgy that we've just lived through. The economic rights of the American people have names: Social Security, the GI Bill of Rights, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, Lend-Lease, in the sense that it wiped out unemployment in 1940 and 1941, the Wagner Act for Labor, and so on down the line. Franklin D. Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights from the January 1944 State of the Union Address will now be sent again to the Congress with the invitation that they elaborate this into a series of constitutional amendments. Our political rights are precious, but our economic and social rights must now also be addressed. The tradition of the Constitution is to expand the purview of our rights, including blacks, women, and others. This must now be extended to economic rights. In this regard, the following actions are being taken under the Defense Production Act, Trading with the Enemy Act, and other relevant legislation. The reactionary union-busting Taft-Hartley Act is hereby abrogated. It is declared inoperative. There will be no right to perpetuate the open shop, the union-busting policies that are common, especially in low-wage employers and sweatshops concentrated in the southern part of the United States, but also in various U.S. territories such as Guam, Saipan, and related areas. These will now be subjected to the provisions of the Wagner Act. This will allow that the labor side of the economic recovery process to be made more efficient and to facilitate the mobilization of labor for national recovery based on union wages. The right-to-work states have now joined the rest of the union, and the debate about low-wage labor or high-wage, adequate compensation for labor has now been historically ended. In regard to this, the Davis-Bacon Act will now be reapplied to all federal contracts of any type under any circumstances. The Davis-Bacon Act mandating union wages for all federal construction projects. The National Labor Relations Board will no longer be a sleepy, inactive, impotent agency, sinecure for careerists on the make. The National Labor Relations Board is going to become a powerhouse under this administration. And we're going to attempt to increase the percentage of the American workforce represented by labor, since when that was the case before, the standard of living was much higher. In terms of enforcement, I'm inviting the Attorney General to investigate Wendy Graham, Alan Greenspan, and Robert Rubin for their role in blocking the regulation of derivatives or even the reportability of derivatives during the 1990s. In terms of foreign policy, I am happy to say that the good neighbor policy is back, and the good neighbor policy is now extended to the world. The period of imperialist intervention, meddling, and interference in the internal affairs of sovereign states is hereby ended. Such meddling, interference, and imperialism in the internal affairs of sovereign states is inadmissible and illegal under the UN Charter, under the Peace of Westphalia, to which the United States is not a party, under the Kellogg-Briand Pact, to which the United States is a party, and under the Conference for Security and Cooperation in Europe of 1975. This will be extended towards all countries. Specifically, I directed the Secretary of Defense to remove all U.S. forces, combat forces, support forces, and all other forces from Iraq within the next 6 months. Their place will be taken by a peacekeeping force, which I've requested the Arab League to provide, and it's our understanding that it will be led by Egypt, Syria, Sudan, with troop contingents from other countries. The Iraq war is hereby over, and this long and useless Calvary of suffering has come to an end. I'm also ordering the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to remove and extract all U.S. forces from Afghanistan over the next 6 months. I'm inviting Pakistan and Iran, as well as the powers of Central Asia, the five former Soviet republics, to provide peacekeeping forces for Afghanistan. The bombing of Pakistan is hereby halted. The Secretary of Defense is hereby ordered to cease and desist all bombing and other military intervention into the sovereign territory of Pakistan. The CIA is hereby directed to cease and desist all covert operations on the territory of Pakistan, Sudan, Burma, and other countries which will be specified. At the same time, we have informed the Polish government and the Czech government that there will be no European missile crisis, no Polish missile crisis. The reckless and irresponsible, ill-advised project of the Bush administration to place anti-ballistic missiles into Poland is hereby abrogated and brought to a halt. At the same time, we look forward to cooperating to all of these countries that have been mentioned in the area of Marshall Plan reconstruction based on the export of high-technology capital goods to these countries under conditions that will allow them to pay for this, creating jobs and economic development here in the United States. A special word for Russia. Russia is a traditional friend of the United States. During the American Revolution, it was Catherine the Great who helped to organize the League of Armed Neutrality, a key supplement to the young American Navy on the oceans of the world against the superior British fleet. It was in 1863 that Tsar Alexander II sent the Russian fleets to New York and San Francisco as a sure sign to the British and the French that if they intervened in favor of the Confederacy, they would face war in Europe and likely destruction. In September 2001, the restraint of Russian President Putin was instrumental in pulling the world back from the brink of a possible thermonuclear exchange, which was implicit in the events of that day. The United States has no conflicts of interest with Russia whatsoever. And we look forward to a new era of Russian-American friendship similar to the one promoted by Abraham Lincoln and his ambassador Cassius Clay in St. Petersburg at that time. I hereby warn the governments of Ukraine, Poland, Georgia, and other countries that further acts of provocation against Russia will not enjoy the support of the United States. In addressing the people of China, we must also respect the territorial integrity of China. This means stopping any CIA support for Muslim insurgency and terrorist movements in the areas of Chinese Turkestan, Xinjiang province, or anywhere else on Chinese territory. Concerning the delicate question of Taiwan, I propose a solution based on the long-term wisdom of the Chinese classics and the Chinese sages, that is to say that the Republic of China and Taiwan accept, in principle, the sovereignty of the government in Beijing, with the details to be worked out over a period of between 50 and 100 years, thereby immediately freezing any question of Taiwan independence and putting Taiwan, as was done with Hong Kong, on a long-term track towards reintegration with the mainland, also following the example of Macau. To the DPRK, North Korea, I say that the United States will not attack you under any circumstances and that we offer you the non-aggression pact formally signed, which you have requested, which we will then back up with a Marshall Plan for the entire region. CIA covert operations among friendly countries are hereby halted. We can promise that there will be no more color revolutions, no more CIA people power coups, no support for the product of those coups in Ukraine, Georgia, Poland, Kosovo, and elsewhere. In terms of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, we are calling a halt to all out-of-area deployments. NATO must revert to its previous positive role as a purely defensive alliance in the limited geographical area of the North Atlantic, and we imagine that its activity will become calmer and calmer as the decades go by. In terms of institutional reform here in the United States, we announced the creation of a Terrorism and Assassination Truth Commission. To look back to the questions of September 11th, the Kennedy assassination, the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, the Bay of Pigs, and Pearl Harbor, to name just a few, we will welcome evidence being given by opposition figures, dissidents, foreigners, or any other person who will be given the full opportunity to make their points and a respectful hearing, and the entire proceedings will be available on the Internet and also on cable television. Concerning Pearl Harbor, we expect that Franklin D. Roosevelt will be completely exonerated from the absurd charges that have been made against him by the Roosevelt haters over the decades, the reactionary Republicans of the Hamilton Fish School, and that it will be found that Colonel Stimson, General Marshall, Admiral Richmond K. Turner, and Winston S. Churchill were responsible for withholding the necessary intelligence and generally sabotaging the possibility of warding off this attack. All of these efforts must be crowned by the calling of a Bretton Woods conference of all sovereign states in the world, starting with great powers such as the European Union, Japan, Russia, China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, Pakistan, South Africa, Nigeria, and others, to create a new world monetary system of the type which has not existed since August 15, 1971. Necessary components of this system will be a system of fixed parities or narrow bands of fluctuation among the major currencies to remove and obviate the element of risk which has brought the economic activity of the world to the point of breakdown. We will also need to introduce gold settlement, that is the clearing and settling of balances among the central banks of nations in terms of gold bullion as a reality principle, and to prevent countries from chronically running deficits and neglecting their productive plant and equipment, as has so obviously happened in the United States. The goal of this system must be written into the treaty. It is to provide the fullest degree of scientific, technological, and economic development in industry and agriculture for all of humanity, including high technology, high wage, high energy intensity, high capital intensity, and high living standard jobs. We must recall that wealth must be produced before it can be distributed. The distribution of existing wealth will be woefully insufficient and will hardly be noticeable in the more poverty-stricken areas of South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. We propose that the world be rebuilt according to a series of great projects, starting with such long-delayed reforms as the Dakar to Djibouti Magnetic Levitation Railway, the Cape to Cairo Magnetic Levitation Railway, the building of a comprehensive Nile-Congo River system of internal and coastal waterways, and related projects applied to other parts of the world. We say to Latin America that the era of American interference and imperialism into Latin America has now come to an end, and the good neighbor policy is in force. The United States will look with favor on efforts for the economic integration of Latin America from the point of view of rationalizing, streamlining, and making that economy more efficient. And to crown these efforts, I am declaring a comprehensive, unlimited debt moratorium for the duration of the crisis on all international financial debt owed to the Club of Paris and the Club of London, as well as to the United States Federal Reserve or the United States Treasury. No longer will debt service be allowed to cause genocide and the death of human beings in Africa, South Asia, or any other part of the world. The motivation of this program is to promote the end of the era of clash of civilizations and clash of religions, as we will explain. The goal of these programs is to end the period of clash of civilizations, wars of civilizations, and conflicts among religion. We look to the shared heritage of humanity, in particular to the concept of Christian charity and the notion of good works as elaborated by St. Paul and developed then in the philosophy of Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz and others. We look to the philosophy of Confucian benevolence as developed in China between 400 and 500 B.C. and developed not only by Confucius but also by his follower Mencius. We look to the tradition of Muslim social solidarity and the need to take care of all members of a society. Let us now build on these concepts and related ones that exist in many of the cultures of the world and institute a Marshall Plan for the entire world in the form of economic development. We can never forget the 40,000 human beings who perish every day from starvation, malnutrition, and diseases that can be cured for pennies. As long as 40,000 people die every day, the world cannot be stable and will never be peaceful. And there is every indication that this terrible number, this tragic number, is increasing because of the results of the world economic depression. The Marshall Plan for the world can be expressed through the foundation of a multilateral development bank with 0% interest rates, long maturity loans, to allow the rest of the world to buy the high technology capital goods, which it is our intention to produce as part of our program of economic recovery. We have idle factories. We have jobless workers. We have the remains of an infrastructure. We can produce such high technology capital goods, energy intensive goods for the world. You have to remember that capitalism produces a real absolute profit. Otherwise, civilization would not have gotten as far as it has gotten today. A capitalist entrepreneur, if he is lent productive capital goods, if those capital goods represent the potential for self-expanding use value, then combining those capital goods with productive labor at the appropriate levels of the standard of living will create a real absolute profit, allowing economic development and an improvement in the lot of humanity. There is no falling rate of profit. There is no doom awaiting capitalism unless it is finance capitalism. Industrial capitalism has been made to work and can be made to work again, but it's necessary to remove the parasitical layer of finance capitalists from it. The tradition that we represent is otherwise that of the modern nation state, having its origins back in northern Italy around 1100, in that area where the influence of the Pope and the influence of the Holy Roman Emperor tended to cancel each other out and allow the emergence of city-states as the pilot project for the modern state. In particular, we look back to Gian Galeazzo Visconti in Milan in the 1380s, who promised debt relief to farmers as a means of fighting his oligarchical enemies. We look back to Louis XI, the Valois King of France, who fought the Duke of Burgundy and the assorted titled feudal aristocrats and nobility who wanted to continue the plague of private warfare and economic exploitation of the French peasantry. We look back to Henry VII, the Earl of Richmond, who defeated the robber barons. The model was the king and the middle class in the cities against the feudal oligarchs. We are continuing the thousand-year-old war of the middle class against the robber barons. This is a government of the middle class, those who are members of it and those who would like to join it. And this, of course, emphatically includes blue-collar workers. The nation state is the best solution to the problems of human civilization, which has yet been found. And the potential of the nation state is still far, far from being exhausted. Let me challenge those people who rail against big government to realize that power will go somewhere. And if power is not located in a sufficiently powerful national state, it will then gravitate towards some form of empire. And this is what many refer to as the New World Order. The New World Order is nothing but a malevolent and exploitative empire which hovers above the nation states and robs them of their national sovereignty and guarantees the destruction of human civilization as we've known it. So those, ironically, who go around saying that they don't like big government in the name of fighting the New World Order are simply guaranteeing that the empire will prevail and that they will be found living in some mini-state or micro-state or regional state, which will be totally impotent in dealing with J.P. Morgan Chase, with Exxon Mobil, with the International Monetary Fund, the British Commonwealth, and other oppressive forces in the world. I issue a warning to those who would subvert the nation state. There were those who would subvert the nation state under the guise of false flag terrorism of the type that we've seen in the assassinations of the 1960s, the Bay of Pigs, and in the 9/11 events. I issue a warning to those who talk of secessionism and the institution of mini-states, micro-states, or regional states here in the United States. This administration will be Grant, Sherman, Sheridan, and Thomas to come after you, put you out of business, expose you, and prevent the subversion of one of the main historical achievements of humanity. You may be asked what the philosophy of this approach is. The right-wing talk show hosts will scream socialism and communism. It is, rather, the American system. Not the Austrian school, but the American system. Not the Chicago school, but the American system. Certainly not the Malthusian Keynesian school, who teach that technology is impossible. We are told that global warming makes high technology, capital goods, and energy-intensive production impossible. We're told that we must put our hopes on renewable energy. In the past several days, in Bismarck, North Dakota, we registered minus 44 degrees, the coldest reading in many, many decades. Chicago has just had its coldest day in 10 years. Generally speaking, the High Plains and Western Great Lakes region have just gone through the biggest cold snap in their entire history. The fanatical followers of global warming refuse to point to any specific test which would provide an empirical verification or refutation of the thesis that they propose to use to reorganize the world and indeed to preside over the deaths of millions of people from lack of production. This government rejects and repudiates global warming as a new big lie, the modern version of Nazi race science, a completely unverifiable and unverified doctrine which is supposed to govern the fate of hundreds of millions of people. We reject this obscenity, and we will not allow it to stand. I'm directing all federal agencies to search their staffs. Any person holding a federal job as a result of a degree in climatology is hereby fired. We need oceanographers, geographers, astronomers, meteorologists, geologists, and others. But we do not need charlatans and quackademics with degrees in climatology, which appears to be a degree which has been specifically designed to promote the falsities of global warming. We reject the Austrian school that says that production is not possible and that depression should be allowed to take its course. We reject creative destruction. We propose to fight the depression. We propose to fight the depression and to defeat it. We propose to stop the depression within a short period of time and return through the path of economic development without any phase of creative destruction or the destruction of a generation through poverty and misery over years as we await the recovery in the way that Herbert Hoover did. The American system, rather, is the system of Governor John Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, of Benjamin Franklin, the founder of the Postal Service, George Washington, who built canals in Virginia, Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay, Friedrich List, the Carey family, Lincoln, the Justin Morrill who put his name on the Great Morrill Tariff and the Great Morrill Act, along with the populists of the 1880s and 1890s, the New Deal, and John F. Kennedy. And it is in this spirit that we invite all citizens and all persons around the world to join in the great enterprise of world economic development and saving civilization from the greatest crisis that we have ever faced.